This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Richard Middleton. He's a scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory in the Earth and Environmental Sciences Division. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Now, you are deeply involved in issues of climate science, carbon dioxide, carbon capture, climate impacts. And I thought we could start by talking about this whole world called carbon dioxide capture, utilization, and storage. Three different things. Carbon dioxide goes into the air, and there's a number of ways that it can be captured. The most natural way is through plants.
Yes.
What else? What are the technological ways?
Well, so in terms of plant capture, we're talking about terrestrial sequestration, and there are even ideas of having the trees capture the CO2 and bury the trees, cut the trees down, bury them for sequestration purposes, keeping that CO2 away from the atmosphere. Of course, this is not necessarily a very logical or viable way of doing it.
It sounds completely insane. I'm just going to say that.
It is. And but some people even believe that what we're looking at, we often call CO2 capture and storage, CCS. Sometimes the utilization is put in there. We'll talk about that in a minute. That's the idea that you can utilize the CO2 for another purpose, such as enhanced oil recovery, producing more oil from depleted reservoirs. But the idea of CCS typically is we have large...
CCS
is CO2 capture and storage. DOE and other agencies like to put the U in there, CO2 capture, utilization, and storage. So sometimes you hear CCS, sometimes CCUS. In many ways, it's easier just to think of CCS, I think, a shorter three-letter acronym. But CCS, typically the idea is you have these large sources of CO2, coal-fired power plants, natural gas power plants, maybe even iron and steel manufacturing. They produce a lot of CO2 from a single source. And then CCS, the capture part, you separate the CO2, clean it, compress it at that large CO2 source, put it into pipelines, and you ship it to these CO2 reservoirs or sequestration reservoirs, where you inject the CO2 under the ground into either deep saline aquifers or maybe depleted oil fields, where the CO2 will be kept away from the atmosphere for hundreds and thousands of years.
Why does it not bubble back up to the surface? I mean, it's a gas.
Well, it is, but except once you've compressed it to a liquid or supercritical state and you inject it deep enough where the pressure is high enough, it stays as a supercritical fluid. There are issues about it rising up, but once it's under the subsurface, approximately 1,000 meters and deeper, it's actually a supercritical fluid and not a gas anymore.
So what is the math behind all that? I mean, it takes a certain amount of energy to capture the carbon, to compress it, to move it to these locations, which are presumably not the same locations as where the plants are producing it. So there's a lot of energy or some amount of energy involved in that.
Yes. So no, great question. And that's one of the biggest drawbacks of CCS in general, that there's a big energy penalty for capturing the CO2. For example, at your typical coal-fired power plant, you're probably looking at a 30-35% energy penalty for capturing the CO2. This includes taking steam off the steam cycle to help capture the CO2 and electricity for the compression. So you're reducing the efficiency of your power plant by capturing the CO2.
There's also the question of whose job is it to do that? Is it something that the power plant is required to do, or is it a public thing that, you know, the government is building this capture? I mean,
well, obviously, governments around the world are looking at how you can stimulate CCS. Europe has a few pilot plants. The U.S. has a few pilot plants doing this, and Canada. But that's the biggest challenge, that the energy penalty basically translates into an economic penalty.
Yeah.
And for some estimates for a coal-fired power plant, for example, you might end up doubling the cost of electricity by installing CO2 capture and storage, at least by retrofitting onto existing power plants. And that's a cost that often, particularly in America, the public aren't necessarily willing to pay right now.
It also then, if that were to become mandatory, would really drive energy use toward alternative forms of energy or renewable energy, which then becomes cheaper.
Yes. And it's a great point that one of the ideas that some people have behind CCS is that it kind of levels the playing field for carbon emissions, that it makes coal power plants, gas power plants more expensive to operate, which then makes renewable energy sources, wind, solar, much more cost competitive and helps us move away from this carbon dominated economy. Obviously, the story is much more complex than that, but that is one of the goals that many people have for CCS. One of the arguments that you often see is that maybe the US and some developed countries can move away from the coal and gas dominated electricity generation. But we know, for example, countries like China have spent over the last 10 years putting a lot of effort into developing new coal-fired power plants. And a typical coal-fired power plant might have a 50 or 75-year footprint. And so the only way really to reduce the CO2 emissions from that power plant is CO2 capture and storage. And in the US, we're seeing, I think right now, there are very few, if any, coal-fired power plants on the books for any utilities being developed. So that's clearly been one outcome of energy policies in the last decade. Let's say that utilities are moving towards natural gas power plants rather than coal-fired power plants.
Now, natural gas power plants are still emitting CO2.
Correct. And they emit, though, about just under half the amount of CO2 per megawatt generated. And on top of that, of course, we have this kind of shale gas revolution right now, which has driven down the cost of natural gas. And so you have this kind of double whammy of reduced costs and reduced CO2. And maybe I think you can make the argument that that's kind of taken off the pressure to develop CCS because we are reducing our CO2 footprint relatively and using a cheaper fuel source right now.
When you look at CCS, carbon capture and storage, how much of a difference, given all the different ways that carbon is being emitted into the atmosphere? I mean, it's not just through coal-fired or natural gas power plants. It's also through transportation, through agriculture, through many other sectors of our society and our economy. How much of a difference can that actually make, CCS?
Well, one way to look at it is there's this concept that came out 10 or 15 years ago from a couple of guys at Princeton. And they developed this concept of climate stabilization wedges, where each of these wedges refers to a separate technology and the amount of impact they can have of reducing CO2 emissions. And they came up with originally maybe a set of 15 wedges, and you needed 7 of these wedges really to stabilize atmospheric CO2. These wedges could be, one of them was CCS, but there's fuel switching away from oil, building efficiency, a whole range of these wedges that all have to come together to make a difference. And so you've made a good point in the sense that CCS is not the whole answer. It's just one or two of these wedges out of the 7 or 8 that we would need. But it's still a very important one. Going back to the example of China, for example, it's a way of reducing emissions from existing sources that can't really shift to renewables, at least in the short or the medium term.
For a place like China where they're building and have been building coal plants for a while, and they're slated, as you say, to keep doing it. In a country like that, would it make a bigger difference than in the United States to have carbon capture?
Well, it might. Again, if you look at the profile of our power plants in the United States, I think the average coal-fired power plant is now probably 40 to 45 years old. Maybe I think the average is around 40 years old if you look at the boilers in these power plants. And so a lot of them are coming to the end of their natural life cycle. And like I kind of said before, a lot of these utilities are deciding to move. If they have to build a new power plant, it's going to be natural gas. It's cheaper. And you're not going to be affected by some of the new EPA rules looking at CO2 emissions. Whereas in China, I don't think you have quite the same pressures to do that. And then one of the projects that we are actually working on with CO2 capture and storage is something called the Clean Energy Research Center, or CERC. It's the US-China CERC for, it's actually Advanced Advanced Coal Technologies Consortium. We call it the Clean Coal CERC. And that's looking at having American and Chinese teams work side by side on CO2 capture issues to see what we can do. And China's still pushing ahead, at least in terms of the research and some pilot plants and understanding how CO2 capture and storage could work in China. And one of the expertise areas that we bring from Los Alamos, in addition to the sequestration or the storage piece, is the utilization. They're very interested in understanding how well they can use their captured CO2 for enhanced oil recovery again, producing more oil from depleted oil fields.
So CCS, carbon capture and storage, sometimes CCUS, carbon capture utilization and storage. How can you utilize CO2 if you're not a plant?
Well, slightly beyond my area of expertise, but what my group within Earth and Environmental Sciences at Los Alamos is working on is understanding how you can utilize CO2 to produce more oil from these depleted oil reservoirs. Once a typical oil field has gone through primary production, where you just stick your well in and you produce oil, secondary production, where you repressurize the field with water. We have something called tertiary production, where we use CO2 for enhanced oil recovery, where you can inject CO2 and water into a field to get those last bits of oil out of the oil field. And that's what we mean by utilization. One of the difficulties for CCS is there aren't that many large-scale utilization opportunities. It's not as though, for example, we drink enough Coca-Cola to store the CO2 in the drinks or anything like that. It's yeah. really oil recovery and maybe gas recovery, the really big options for utilizing all of the CO2 that we have to be capturing. For example, right now in the US, we are using something like 70 million tons of CO2 a year for enhanced oil recovery, maybe 50 to 70 million tons a year. And most of that CO2 is not from man-made sources. There's significant reservoirs of CO2 already that we can go and mine. We have significant reservoirs in Colorado. We have a pipeline that goes along the whole diagonal northwest to southeast of New Mexico carrying CO2. Basically, we're mining CO2 out of the ground to send it to Texas to re-inject to produce more oil. If we can displace that mined CO2 with anthropogenic CO2, then this could be a good start to jump-starting CCS. And we have a couple of papers of this already from our group.
Why is CO2 better at cleaning out those last drops of oil? I sort of think of it as like putting a spoon in the jar to get the last little bits of honey out. Why is that better than any other gas that you could just pull out of the air?
Well, it's another good question. Again, slightly beyond my area of expertise, there are multiple gases that you can inject to enhance oil recovery. People inject liquid natural gas is another one. The key term here is miscible. CO2 is miscible with oil. It can basically mix in with the oil, become a single miscible fluid that changes the viscosity that allows you to more easily produce this oil that's been trapped in the oil field. Though it's important to remember, even after enhanced oil recovery, going through primary, secondary, and tertiary recovery, you're still probably leaving half of the oil in the ground. And again, this is one of the challenges that Los Alamos has, particularly our division, Earth and Environmental Sciences, a challenge that we're trying to address. For example, we have another big project, not led by me, led by Hari Viswanathan at Los Alamos, looking at using CO2 for hydraulic fracturing. The idea is that using CO2 as the fracturing fluid and not water could be much more efficient in terms of generating fractures and producing this shale gas than using water.
So whether you're doing fracking or whether you're doing that extra oil recovery, when the CO2 mixes with, let's say, the oil, it becomes a miscible fluid, comes out, what happens to the CO2 then?
Another great question. For oil, oil companies, they try to recycle as much of the CO2 as they can. As they produce in the oil, they have certain techniques where they can flash or take the CO2 out of the produced oil, and they recompress that CO2 and then use it again to re-inject.
So it's not being transformed chemically into anything else. It's still CO2, whether it's been mined, as you say, or produced from a smokestack.
Correct. And, you know, there's some debate out there among scientists whether we should be using the word storage or sequestration. And some of it gets back to some people like to use the word storage because we're not necessarily converting what the CO2 looks like. We're not mineralizing it with the rocks down there or anything. And so maybe we're just storing it for hundreds of thousands of years rather than permanently sequestering it in the ground.
If there were real breakthroughs in renewable technology where energy produced from the sun became orders of magnitude more efficient and more abundant, could you turn CO2 into essentially oxygen and carbon, coal, diamonds, whatever is made of carbon?
I suppose, but that would be beyond my kind of thinking. But they have been, that there are certain reactions of things you can apply to, and I was on one project that you tried to use the CO2 combined with some other things and solar energy to make fossil fuels from the CO2 that you produced. Again, the energy penalty is so high that we can do it in theory, but in practice we're not there yet.
So basically it's reversing combustion.
In some ways, I guess you would be able to say that. I'm not a chemist. Chemist is kind of like my kryptonite, and so I have to be careful what I say. But yes, there could be in the future some very exciting things we do with the CO2 rather than just pumping it into the ground and storing it away from the atmosphere.
We're talking to Richard Middleton from the Los Alamos National Laboratory Earth and Environmental Sciences Division. Another thing that you look at is climate impacts. And so, I mean, in the state of New Mexico, where we are, what are you looking at? Are you looking worldwide? Are you looking locally?
We are looking from the very fine scale. Some of our watersheds up in the Hamer's Mountains, for example, that are just a few square kilometers, right up to some very large regional areas like the whole Colorado River. And we're just very interested in understanding what the climate change impacts could be in these areas. In particular, what we're focused on is what we call climate-driven disturbances. And the big three disturbances that we're looking at, the first is drought mortality, the idea that with the heating, drying in the future, that a lot of our trees, our forests are going to be dying. So we call that the vegetation mortality. The second climate-driven disturbance we look at is wildfire, something that we're very keenly aware of here in New Mexico. And the third is insects and pathogens, which we call infestation. And we're trying to understand how do these climate-driven disturbances impact our ecosystems, but in particular focusing on the impact on hydrology. So one of the emerging areas that we have in Los Alamos is the energy-water nexus, this balance between energy and water moving forwards. And our key niche at Los Alamos that we're building, that we don't think any other national lab has, and maybe nobody else has as well as we do, is understanding how these climate-driven disturbances are going to impact the energy-water nexus.
Now, the energy-water nexus, let's talk about that a little bit. If my understanding is correct, it's this whole reality that you need water to produce energy and you need energy to move water.
Exactly. And energy to treat water.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you look at California, I don't recall the exact numbers, but something around 10 to 12% of electricity is for moving and treating water. And so it's a really big energy consumption. And then you get this concept, one of the ways to reduce energy is to reduce water usage. The less water you use, the less energy you need to treat and move that water around.
And of course, you need water to produce energy. I mean, you were talking about hydraulic fracturing, which a lot of people think shouldn't be happening in the first place, but nevertheless, it's happening. That uses water. Every energy plant that is using turbines to basically boil water and produce electricity uses quite a lot of water, some of which disappears through evaporation, a lot of which is recycled. But there's an awful lot of water use in making energy.
Yeah, so if you look at the United States, around, I don't remember the exact numbers, around 40% of our water is used for agriculture, around 40% of it is used for energy generation, particularly thermoelectric power. Now, there becomes a debate about whether that water is consumptive or not. For example, a lot of power plants east of the Mississippi they use something called once through cooling. They take the water, they pass it through the power plant, they take out the heat through that process and then put it back into the river. So it uses a lot of water but doesn't actually consume as much as agriculture. But regardless, you can see for our food production and for energy production and extraction, we're using a lot of water. And so when you do have a new technology like hydraulic fracturing, even though it doesn't use as much as electricity generation, at least on an individual well basis, when you have thousands of wells that have these water needs, you start to see pressure on the energy water nexus, which again, we talked a bit about using CO2 for fracturing. That would be one of the other benefits, that you can reduce the water footprint and the pollution from this dirty water coming up.
But you still are going to produce natural gas, which is then going to be sent to a plant where they use water to make electricity.
Yes.
So it seems like, and again, those of us who are not involved in the kind of work you do stand back and say, isn't it kind of a no-brainer to do solar and to do wind that don't use water at all and that don't produce CO2 at all?
I mean, obviously there's a big drive towards between these kinds of these renewable energy sources, but it's not necessarily the perfect solution, maybe perhaps for the US. There, I mean, we start to see limits. We know Germany, for example, has really been pushing the boundary in renewable energy. But one of the ironies that's come out of it is that once the renewable energy sources of energy have deployed for producing electricity, they've actually ended up producing more CO2 from coal-fired power plants, particularly since they've reduced some of their nuclear power generation.
In Germany?
Yeah. They're the kind of the almost a golden child in Europe for renewable energy generation, but it's not quite the perfect solution yet. So of course, we should be looking to some of these renewable energy solutions because they have that lower CO2 footprint, they have the lower water footprint, but there's still going to be some issues that we need to tackle in the meantime.
When you are looking at these climate impacts of wildfire, of drought, and of insect infestation, these are all caused by climate change. There's also issues with wildfire of fire suppression policy in the past, making wildfires worse, and we've talked about that quite a bit. Over the years, what is your role as a scientist to study that, to look at it, not necessarily to offer solutions?
Well, there's two or three things we're looking at. The first one is we kind of really want to understand, to predict when these impacts are going to happen and to quantify their impacts. And the reason that it will be useful for society is helping us to plan for what the future is going to be. How much water is going to be in, for example, the Colorado River moving forward when you're looking at climate change and these climate-driven disturbances. So that's kind of this prediction and quantification piece of the project that we're looking at. The third piece is kind of what you're referring to, is the mitigation and the planning. Is there anything we can do in the meantime that can increase the resiliency of our ecosystems, particularly our forested ecosystems? We already know a bit about forest treatments, tree thinning to enhance the resiliency of our forests. And part of our project is starting to look at how can we do this to maybe increase the hydrologic resiliency of these forests as well, to make sure to make the forest less vulnerable to drought mortality and to infestation, while also trying to understand the wildfire impact. So it's a bit of a stretch goal for our project, but that's kind of the direction we really want to go. Can we put planning tools and capabilities in the hands of stakeholders to let them better understand how to manage our natural resources?
When you look at forests in New Mexico, like the Jemez, do we have pretty good and clear information and models of what a natural forest in New Mexico is like, you know, before all this fire suppression regimes, like a couple hundred years ago, before anybody was suppressing fire, how thin or thick the forests would be, how often they burned, how many trees would survive or die in fire, that kind of thing?
I think the answer is yes. I'm not a fire ecologist, so I don't have the answer for you, but we have a couple of fire ecologists on the project. Rod Lynn, for example, is our wildfire simulation expert on the project. And there's several other people within the Jemez area that we've been working on that really have this detailed understanding of what our forests look like without some of the climate change that we've already seen and without the fire suppression that we've seen for the last 100 or 200 years. This is particularly important for the Himalayas mountains, of course, because virtually none of it is natural forest. It's been managed so heavily for the last century or two that there aren't many natural stands left. And so people, I think, they do have a good understanding of, for example, today, that we tend to have fewer fires when we have them. They're much more catastrophic. Las Conchas or the Sierra Grande fire, for example. And they have a good understanding of these smaller frequent fires going back, if you look through the historical record, looking at tree rings and other data.
It's odd to live in a world where there are so many landscapes that look like natural landscapes, but they're not.
Yes. Again, not exactly my area of expertise, but obviously, particularly here in New Mexico, everything has undergone dramatic changes, and whether it's ranching or forestry or urbanization, and we've obviously had a very big impact on our ecosystems. And that is actually a big, still an important part of our project, understanding the man-made impacts on the ecosystem, not just the climate-driven disturbances. And like you brought up, wildfire is a very good example of an interaction between the climate and how these systems have been physically managed.
You are part of a project called the Critical Watersheds Project, and I'll read you the whole title: Critical Watersheds, Climate-Driven Disturbances, and the Energy Water Nexus. Some of the stuff we've been talking about. What are the goals of this program?
Well, this Critical Watersheds Program, it's a internally funded project at Los Alamos, what we call this the LDRD program. This is Los Alamos's opportunity to support some emerging ideas and grow these ideas that can grow into a much larger project going forwards. And this Critical Watersheds project is looking at these climate-driven disturbances and the impact on our water supply, impact on hydrology. And again, this is the project that's looking at vegetation mortality, wildfire, and insect infestation. We're about halfway through this project. It's a $3 million project. One of the recent things that we've done with the project is looking at these regional scale impacts. We're looking at the San Juan Basin, for example, in the Colorado River Basin, and we're just starting to move up to look at the whole Colorado River Basin. But what we started to see in the San Juan is, if you just look at climate change and how it impacts hydrology, depending on which climate model you're using, but we use three particular climate models, stream flow actually goes up with climate change going out to the year 2100. So that's just looking at climate change.
What? Say that again. Stream flow goes up?
Because some of the precipitation in these three climate models is also going to go up in as we go through the 21st century. You always have to remember that there's multiple climate models, Earth system models out there. They all have different assumptions and they all have different outcomes. And so if you looked at a different set of climate models, you might see stream flow going down, which is often what you see for projects looking at the Colorado River and its sub-basins. But for the three GCMs, the global climate models we looked at, you saw a 6% increase in flow over that period.
Why is that?
Mostly, again, it's just driven by the precipitation. There is just, they're projecting the precipitation will be up slightly in the southwest region. But one of the key findings that we found, and we're just writing this up right now, is that when you put dynamic vegetation, this is the how vegetation changes because of these climate driven disturbances, once you put in these vegetation disturbances and getting instead of getting a 6% increase in flow, we're seeing around the 15 to 20% decrease in flow. We see a change in the signal for when we put in climate driven disturbances. This particular work is led by one of the scientists on the project, Katrina Bennett, and it's a very important part of the project for us, looking particularly coupled with the energy water nexus. When we're trying to understand how much water is going to be available for energy production and extraction, we really need to know what's going to be happening with that water supply.
Now, wait a minute. You just slow down for us a little bit. You're saying that because of your models showing precipitation going up 6%, but then going down 15%.
Well, so the precipitation stays the same in the climate model.
I mean stream flow.
Yes. So precipitation's the same. We run the base We run the base model, we get the 6% increase in flow. The only thing we change when we rerun this is we put in the climate-driven disturbances, principally the way the forest and the San Juan will be impacted by increasing temperature. This is based on Nate McDowell and Chonggang Chu's work, who are also part of this work at Los Alamos. So nothing changed apart from we dynamically changed the vegetation to account for how trees are projected to be dying in the southwest. When you put that tree death in, this widespread mortality, that's where it goes from a 6% increase in stream flow to approximately 15% decrease in stream flow.
So what's the relationship between stream flow and tree death?
Well, there's a very complex nonlinear relationship between it, and there's actually still a lot of debate out there for what's going on. One of the key things we can see is the way the snowpack changes when you have this tree death, and the snowpack is very, very important for stream flow out here in the southwest. Most of the base stream flow, the stream flow that we see throughout of the year, is a lot of that is recharged from the snowpack melting. So any changes in the spacing between trees or the clumpiness of the trees can have a really big impact on what stream flows look like. And that's why it's really critical sometimes to get into these details to understand what's going to happen to our ecosystems with widespread tree mortality.
It's important to understand these things so that policy decisions can be made. And it's very difficult for citizens to really know what to do. I mean, you get into this situation where you're like, trees are dying, that affects stream flow because of snowpack, and there's like no consumer choice or human choice that I can make possibly short of voting, and even that probably not so much, that really has an impact.
Sure, I agree. It's a very complex situation, particularly with the research we're looking at. We're stretching out projections to the year 2100. I think it's very difficult for society to understand making those long-term projections. And again, the impact that we can have as individuals. I mean, efficient energy use, efficient water use is obviously a very good way to start. And a lot of governments, right down to even here, the Santa Fe, local government making changes about how much water is used in toilets or energy efficiency. There are at least one way that we can adapt and mitigate, well, not mitigate, but at least adapt to future water supplies under future climate scenarios.
For you, as both a scientist and a citizen, and somebody who has four children and is looking toward the future, what are your hopes for the kinds of decisions that we make as a society?
I think it's a difficult and complex question. From our science perspective, we at least want to put the information out there to. You know, I think it's very difficult to make a reasoned-based decision until you have the scientific evidence out there. And of course, that's what we're partly trying to do with our Critical Watersheds project. Beyond that, I'm not really sure the direction to go. I mean, we're not trying to scare people here with our projections. We just want to put the evidence out in front of people.
No matter how scary they may be.
Yeah, and it could be. But, you know, I would argue the positive side is that throughout the world, and particularly in America, we've been very good at tackling some of these big issues. And maybe if we put the evidence out there, even where there's some debate about the evidence, I think putting it out there will enable us to make better decisions. And we do have this track record of tackling big challenges, and so I at least try to remain positive about this.
Richard Middleton, you have not one, not two, but three geography degrees. You're from England. What is the study of geography? I think is it more of something that you might do in England or in Europe than here?
Well, the discipline of geography is certainly more well known in England. In America, it's probably perhaps less well known. It's one of those. It's perhaps one of the most diverse degrees that you can be studying. I mean, you have way out. You have Marxist geography and feminist geography, very qualitative subjects, right through to where my wife graduated from UC Santa Barbara was very quantitative. So, for example, on my committees, my committee would have had maybe 9 degrees between them, and they probably only had one geography degree. They're physicists and statisticians, etc. So it's a very wide-ranging subject, but it's a great subject to go into. There's a whole range of things you can do, and that's kind of, once I landed at Los Alamos, that's how I've been able to work on these kind of low-carbon, reduced-carbon energy research and the climate impact research that I've been doing.
What do you actually study when you study geography of the kind that you did?
Well, the geography that I was focusing on was very quantitative, so statistics, mathematics. We do a lot of computer coding. You see people doing remote sensing. They do climate work. But again, there are geography departments that are very, very different. They look at human geography, understanding how society works. Transportation is a very big part of human geography, for example.
I mean, when I think of geography, and we're going back to the third grade here, I think of maps. I mean, etymologically, you are writing the earth, you're mapping.
It does. And so, you know, the typical joke you get with one or even three geography degrees is making jokes about mapping and directions and also becoming a geography teacher. But actually, the mapping is very, very powerful. There's something that we do a lot at Los Alamos called GIS, Geographical Information Systems, or Geographical Information Science. It's basically a way of digitally mapping the world. And maps are a very powerful way to convey information. And even though GIS has not been that popular at Los Alamos, I think when anybody sees these GIS maps, these digital maps, they can get an insight to the problem that they're looking at that they might not have necessarily seen before. So it's a very, very powerful tool, and it's a great tool for any, you know, any students to get into. There's a lot of jobs out there for GIS, but even in terms of science, it's a really powerful way to move forward with science.
Give us some specific examples of the kinds of insights that GIS might give you that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
Well, even on this critical watersheds project that we've been talking about, we do a lot of mapping, understanding where these climate-driven disturbances have occurred. And even just visually looking at these maps, you can start to see where the disturbance is more likely to happen on a north-facing slope or a south-facing slope. Even something basic like that, you can start to see this message popping out.
And is the insight like when you actually see it on a screen before you visually? Patterns emerge?
Well, my argument is by even just plotting this data on the screen, you start to see these patterns that you hadn't necessarily thought about. For example, back in the Department of Geography, working with my advisor at UC Santa Barbara, he was and still is, you know, the leader in his field. He's a spatial optimization guy. He does operations research. And most of his optimization is spatial. You know, he's been a world leader for 30 years in this. And even as a graduate student, I went there just plotting the data on the screen. He started to see connections, understanding how things operate that he didn't necessarily see before. Again, just by visualizing what things look like spatially.
I have to ask you this, since you used this term before. What is feminist geography?
I've never studied it myself. But, you know, there are out on the edges the Marxist geography, feminist. Basically, geography is in some ways a clearinghouse for a lot of other subjects where people come in looking at the spatial component. So at UC Santa Barbara, there was a strong component on behavioral geography or kind of psychology geography. People from sociology and psychology would come across and they're trying to understand, for example, how people understand giving directions to go somewhere. And you can see the connection between psychology and geography. So actually, it's to me, it's a fascinating subject because you can go into one of these great geography departments and you get a whole range of other researchers are coming in to understand the spatial component of what their work is looking at.
So basically, it's any subject, psychology, feminism, economics, and putting data from those areas on a map and looking for patterns. Is that...
Well, it doesn't have to be on a map, but it's really looking at the spatial component of what's going on. And so, you know, you mentioned economics. Economic geography is one of the major staples of geography. And I think even, for example, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman, I believe, would call himself an economic geographer at heart. Understanding migration or the movements of money spatially is just something that's very fundamental and it's very exciting to look at.
I've seen maps of Santa Fe that break down the city by income, by race and ethnicity, And also like food maps, like where food is available, and seeing those things visually and color coding them is amazing.
It is. And you, again, just visualizing these things actually leads people to a lot of insights. For example, lower income access to a grocery store.
Yeah.
That is one of the things coming out of geography and GIS that you find a lot of lower income areas have poor access to fresh fruit and vegetable, for example.
Right, right. So what have you learned from mapping, and what kind of, like, the kind of insights that you get from doing GIS, from doing this kind of geographical information mapping for the watersheds here in New Mexico?
Well, looking at the for our critical watersheds project again, we really tried to, I think we're gaining these understanding, new understanding from being able to visually see where the forests are, where the disturbance are, what the river flows look like, the relationship to some of these big thermoelectric power plants. And so again, even just being able to plot these on a map, there's insights that we can gain from this that we don't necessarily pick up before, you know, that helps us understand some of these spatial connections that we just really weren't aware of before.
Richard Middleton is a scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory in the Earth and Environmental Sciences Division. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity to be able to talk about the project and all the good work we're doing.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.